Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. Okay, so I've just finished my period of solitary retreat. It's always delightful to have time to just settle into practice, settle into the forest. I have less contact, less engagement. It's always a treat to have that period of practice in our forest. It's just so quiet up in the forest. Probably say it or mention it fairly often, but it still amazes me how quiet it actually is. You know, daytime, nighttime, there's a lot of stillness in nature. I had this buck coming around. I put out water at my kuti all the time. And there's a dish of water. And this buck coming around, and I'd share some of my food with him. It was really incredibly tame. He'd come up within, on his own, would just come up within about 3-4 feet of me. Or be down doing walking meditation, and you'd just be hanging out down around my walking meditation path, and he'd come up, wander up really close. Very sweet to see that kind of nature. So having time to practice and having time to reflect on the teachings. I think one of the things that always amazes me actually how simple it actually is, the teachings that the Buddha gave us, the way he laid it out. It ain't rocket science. It's not complicated. Of course, that's the problem with the human mind, is its tendency to complicate. And there's a sutta where a wandering ascetic comes to question the Buddha, and his questions are all around philosophical, metaphysical, cosmological speculation. And the Buddha doesn't give him anything to go on at all, and it's not what he teaches. And finally the ascetic gets frustrated and sort of, well, what do you teach? And the Buddha just sort of, well, I just teach the purification of beings, overcoming of suffering, the path of practice. And then the ascetic sort of takes that, well, if people follow this path of practice and this purification of beings, everybody... does everybody get enlightened? Does half the people get enlightened? A third of them get liberated? And I think by that time the Buddha is pretty fed up and just doesn't bother answering. Ananda steps in and out of concern that the wandering ascetic will just get the view that, well, the Buddha can't answer me. He's not capable of answering me. And Ananda gives an image, gives a simile, in the sense that using the image of a fortress city that has very solid ramparts and walls and only one entry point. And there's a wise and discerning watchman who is able to know everybody who goes in, everybody who goes out, And having inspected the fortress, knowing that there's no, as Ananda says it, there isn't enough of a space for even a cat to go in and out. And that person, that watchman, would know that whoever came in or came out of that city would have to go in and out through that one doorway. And then he takes it to the, and he said, and it's similar to the Buddha and the Buddha's teaching, in that it's not really about how many people does everybody get enlightened? Does a half get enlightened? Does a third get liberated? The Buddha knows that whoever will be liberated or is to be liberated or has been liberated in the past, all have come to that point of liberation through this particular way of practice, and that's the overcoming of the hindrances, the qualities that weaken discernment, their four foundations of mindfulness, and the seven factors of enlightenment. These are the this is the path. That's the way. So that, and it's in that way. There's a very straightforward relationship to what we have to learn, what we have to know, what we have to put our attention on, if we're interested in liberation, if we're interested in freedom from suffering, then there's this pretty straightforward things to attend to and apply ourselves to, so that these hindrances, sensual desire, ill will, aversion, sloth and torpor, restlessness and worry, skeptical doubt. And these are the hindrances or obstacles to the mind becoming settled, becoming clear, becoming stable. The four foundations of mindfulness are the mindfulness of the body, mindfulness of feeling, mindfulness of the mind, mindfulness of mental qualities, so that they're those are a basis for our establishing of attention, establishing of awareness, what to be mindful of. And that's as we recognize how to apply our attention, and of course that's something that we learn how to do, whether it's in terms of our ethical conduct, our interactions with other people, actions of body and speech, or the application of the of awareness and attention, so that the mind, the heart becomes more settled and stable and clear, a cultivation of meditative stillness, or the aspects of investigation, contemplation, discernment, wisdom. These are learning how to approach those, or you stay within the boundaries of the foundations of mindfulness, and understanding where, what is it that is grabbing attention? Because sometimes there's, of course, on a certain level, there's only all of our experience is basically only aspects of things about the body, things about feeling in terms of pleasant, painful, neutral, things about the mind in terms of what kind of or what quality of mind or mood is present, and then the actual mental qualities, focuses of attention. That's all we experience, but it's usually not done very consciously. So then we get trapped in our proliferations, our attachments, our views and opinions, our things that we get overwhelmed by, and of course we take it as self. We take it as who we are, and that's the whole, one of the main points of being able to cultivate these foundations of mindfulness, is to be able to see things in the light of Dhamma, see things in the light of say fundamental truths. And Dhamma is it's an interesting word in that it can be, what is truth, what is a duty, what is a reality, what is in accordance with the way things are. So that it has these nuances, but being able to investigate, approach, experience things from a point of Dhamma as opposed to the habit that we have usually of experiencing things through our likes, our dislikes, our fears, our preferences. And of course, then we end up complicating. An idiom, complicating that which does not need to be complicated. It's so that as we use these foundations of mindfulness to ground our attention in, to have it as a basis, and that's the actual word that the Buddha uses, having a foundation of mindfulness. As we have a foundation of mindfulness, attentive and recognizing, okay, this is how we experience the body, this is how to stay with the body, this is how we experience feeling, in the sense of, is it pleasant, is it unpleasant, is it neutral? And it's how we experience the mind, whether it's a mind with greed, without greed, with aversion, without aversion, whether it's kind of constricted mind, whether it's spacious mind, whether it's a scattered mind, whether it's a concentrated mind. This is what the mind is like. This is the basis of our how we experience things through. This is what the mind is like. And then the reflection on, in terms of the last one, of course, is using the word Dhamma again, experiencing things in terms of the mental qualities as phenomena, either wholesome or unwholesome. And again, seeing it from the place of an aspect of a natural truth, as opposed to the the layering of additions that we tend to create in our own minds out of sort of agendas of desire or of attachment. And this brings us, you know, seeing things through the light of Dhamma, you know, seeing things in the way this is something that is not stable, it's not not certain, it's not a sure thing. Definitely not a place to take as a refuge and as something completely satisfying. And it's not self. It's not what we truly are. It's just that. Just what it is. It's just phenomena. And then we have that framework of investigating from the Four Foundations of Mindfulness. It's a lot of stepping back and a natural relinquishing, a natural letting go. And of course, as one views things through the light of Dhamma, that letting go it's not as if one is forcing oneself to let go, or because that's a form of suffering in itself, just trying to make oneself let go. Although that's what, you know, so we begin to practice, we inevitably have to be doing that. We're experimenting with, okay, how do I let go? I should let go. And then the mind sort of, but I don't want to let go. Can't do it. Or why should I bother to let go? It's like having, being upset at something, and then the mind logically comes up with, okay, I should let go. And okay, yeah, right, I should let go. Very good. Yeah, okay, I'm going to let go. And then immediately the mind kicks in, and another aspect of the mind kicks in. But they shouldn't have done that. And it goes on and on. But I think it's the investigation of suffering really. Is essential because there's a point where one realizes that it's actually it's more suffering to hold on than it is to let go, and so then one finally lets go. When we begin the practice, it feels like it's more suffering to let go than to hold on. It feels better to hold on somehow. So then we end up carrying all sorts of burdens. And, Ajahn Chah, and pointing to the somebody asking him, how can you possibly be in the midst of all these people and all these duties keep letting go? How can you do that? And there's just so many things that have to be done, so many people you have to deal with. And Ajahn Chah just sort of saying, see that big rock out there? It's a big Sema stone. See that big rock out there? Is that heavy? And he said, oh yeah, that's really heavy. I said, well, it isn't if you don't pick it up. And it's sort of that simple. And Ajahn Chah was sort of the exemplar of one who practiced diligently, who held the practice very assiduously, but didn't make it heavy, didn't make it a burden. So that quality of recognizing where the suffering is, and that you realize, yeah, it's more suffering to hold on than it is to let go. And to really be looking at that point, because oftentimes we just want to, you know, of course we want to be peaceful, we want to be happy, we want to be serene, but we try to make our minds conform to that as an ideal. And that investigation of suffering is to be able to recognize where is it that we're holding on, and where do we need to let go? Because it's that willingness to look and see all the new and all those different nuances of suffering, you know, whether it's just sort of some minor stress or some niggling kind of agitation or just or you know, just some major blowout. But it's just being able to look at it, being able to pick it up and investigate it, view it as from the place of where is this arising? How is it establishing itself? How to let go? I remember one time going to Ajahn Chah with a difficulty, a problem that not so much in terms of meditation practice, but in terms of conduct and interaction with the community and the taking responsibility for the rules of training, and after sort of explaining and laying it all out, and Ajahn Chah's kind of response. Is it suffering? And is it rather than analyzing it or fixing it for me or telling me what to do that's going to be absolutely right? I'm going to know now when he's going to he's going to be the authority who is going to tell me exactly what's right. He didn't do that. And then, is it suffering? It really took me aback because I didn't see it as suffering. didn't see it as suffering at all. It took me a long time after that to really see it as suffering. But that's looking at it from the point of Dhamma, as opposed to a view, an opinion, a preference, a like or a dislike. It just changes the way one relates to things. So that looking at things from a place of Dhamma, and putting it into practice. Of course, that putting into practice, I'm going to start off with using that example of the the image that Ananda gives of that whoever is going to be liberated, be free from suffering, that's free the mind from hindrances, four foundations of mindfulness, seven factors of enlightenment. So those are practical applications of skillful qualities, mindfulness, reflection of Dhamma, effort, energy, putting effort and energy into the practice, joy or rapture, tranquility, concentration, meditative stability of the mind, and equanimity. And those are the seven factors. So those are qualities that we can be putting our attention onto. We can be applying the mind, and it's a way to balance the mind. Of course, it starts from mindfulness, but there's these wholesome qualities that we can put our attention into. Reflecting, investigating. Dhamma vichaya, investigation of Dhamma, investigation of states, stepping back and reflecting and looking. What is the experience? Not just sort of blindly reacting to the either the external stimulus or the internal habit, but investigating. According to Dhamma, application of effort. And of course, effort is always defined in terms of the effort that allows wholesome Dhammas to increase, wholesome qualities to increase, and the unwholesome to decrease, to be able to be ready to let go of what is unwholesome, unskillful, unprofitable, and to put the effort, energy toward that which allows the wholesome, the skillful, the profitable to increase. And of course, as we do that, there is a natural a joy that comes from that. The mind is uplifted. It doesn't necessarily have to be kind of bright lights and dazzling meditative experiences, but there's an uplift that's quite natural. There's a joy that's there, and it's very satisfying, and it helps the mind to, again, as one experiences that. That enhances that letting go, so that there's more tranquility, there's more settling, there's more stability, and there's a more a firmness of our not being pulled into the things that do create suffering or agitation, that equanimity. Remember Ajahn Chah talking about, and he said, you know, it's internally the mind becomes more equanimous and steady and sure of itself. And he said, as we practice, as we gain experience in the practice, and as we trust ourselves, and he said it's sort of like a father and their child, and the small child. Of course, the small child has got lots of questions. It doesn't understand. It wants to know this, wants to know that, and it's. And the little child is, what's this? What's that? How to do this? And you know, and at first the father sort of puts a lot of attention into explaining everything. But after a while, after a while, that's what you do to your own mind, is it? Because your mind's always, it's got this question, it's got this worry, it's got this fear, it's got this desire, it's got this attachment, it's got this reaction, and you're in the beginning, you're always trying to engage it, and you're getting hooked by it all the time, and after a while, it's just like that, it's just one more thing. Same old stuff. There's an equanimity there that is very natural, and there is this natural quality to the practice, and that's I think of the one of the qualities that the Buddha points to. It's almost like indicative of the mind that is the heart that is really understanding, really penetrating, really learning. And the Pali, Dhammanu Dhamma Patibhata. So, literally, it's sort of practicing Dhamma in accordance with Dhamma. And that's a sort of. And if we try to define it too tightly, you can turn it into a real head trip of. Practicing Dhamma, which Dhammas, with what kind of Dhammas, and make it really complicated. But it again, this sense of these allowing these natural truths to function in harmony with each other, in accordance with truth. And they tend to flow into each other. So it's like, and that's actually one of the kind of the ways that word dhammanu dhamma patibhata. So, but it's sort of like practicing so that the little dhammas fit into the big dhammas. It's one way of teasing the meaning out. But there's this sense of a kind of a naturalness and how it flows into each other. And there's an image that could be useful. Or it's like you've got as if one has these vessels have water, or they may be like a fountain or something. But it's in smaller ones, and it goes into below that is a larger container. Below that's a larger container, and the water comes out of the small one, fills up the small one, it overflows, and it fills up the bigger one. Fills up the bigger one. Fills up the bigger one. And that's how our practice of Dhamma is like. There's this, you know, we pay attention to the little things. And pay attention to one in-breath and one out-breath. And you think, well, that's not a big deal. But it is a big deal, because it fills up other aspects of our training, of our heart. Paying attention to the integrity and virtue, how we hold our actions of body and speech, how we attend to sustaining awareness and investigation, so that there is a settling of the mind, and then kind of a discernment and wisdom naturally arising, so that there's a naturalness there that of course it needs to be, one has to apply oneself in the proper way, and again that's where that Dhamma no Dhamma Patibhata, practicing Dhamma in accordance with Dhamma. Because there's lots of practicings of Dhamma that are pretty far away from the Dhamma, really. So it's learning how to accord with Dhamma, learning how to accord with truth, learning how to accord with the way things are, but paying attention to, of course, paying attention to suffering. What's the result? What's the feeling? That's a really good indication. That's exactly why the Buddha uses that as a basis of so much of his teaching. Learning how to pay attention to causes and conditions. What are the causes and conditions? How does this arise? How does it come apart? How does it cease? And those are fundamentals to understanding the Buddha's teaching and how to put it into practice, and so that as we continue to practice, pay attention to how to understand the fundamentals, how to bring it back to. We don't have to get too fancy and complicated. Just really understand the fundamentals, and you'll find that this is where it takes one to freedom from suffering. So I'll offer that for reflection this evening. Sankaram Dadama Sehi Sankaram.